Good afternoon. Today is Labor Day, September the 7th, 2020. This is John Richardson. I'm speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. The school year is beginning. All kinds of great things happen the first week after Labor Day. And it's another anniversary of a year of the LSAT Study Group blog. And I'm here with Matt Leanwant, who has been very generously and effectively one of the moderators of the LSAT study group for the last year. And this should be an extremely interesting podcast because he's an interesting guy in general, but he's got some really interesting news. And let me just introduce him for those who don't know him. So how are you today, Matt?
I'm doing great, John. I'm doing great. It's a great day down here in Atlanta. It took 2 years to pick a law school, but I am in at Emory Law, and I came down here about 1 month ago.
And it's a happy time for you, going well?
Happy time as far as studying night and day can go, but happy nonetheless. I'm glad I'm here, that's for sure.
So it's going to be your life, I understand, for 4 years instead of 3 years. So how did all that happen?
Yeah, well, I was applying to law schools, and one thing led to another when Emory offered me to apply to the MBA JD joint degree program. And so I thought, you know, this could be really interesting, and this could kind of broaden my horizons and give me more versatility when I apply for jobs. And I genuinely think business is really interesting, and I'd like to go into business law. And so I applied, and I was very generously offered some scholarship to the business school as well. And so I jumped on it. I decided to come down to Atlanta, and I couldn't be happier. I think the Goizueta School of Business is really fantastic, as well as Emory Law. Both have been really great, though I haven't started law classes, but the law office has been really great and really hospitable. I think there's kind of a different energy down at Emory. Everyone is very friendly and very welcoming, and I was not expecting it. It's a different feel communicating with these offices compared to other law schools, I think. Big part of why I came down.
Well, it sounds like you got all kinds of reasons for going down there. I mean, the idea of being able to shave 3 year law and 2 years generally MBA, shave a year off and get two separate degrees in 4 years, that sounds pretty good to me.
It sounds pretty good. The business school is tough. It is a lot of work, but I think it really has, not that it pays off, but I think it's very valuable. The lectures have been very efficient and very detailed. And so even though it's an extra year, it's a lot of work, but I think it will pay off. And I'm really happy to be here for sure.
Well, you've always been a hardworking kind of guy, so I don't think you'd be happy if you were not working hard. That's my guess with you.
And yeah, you're not wrong.
And speaking of, I mean, you know, you've been all over the place with school. I understand you spent a year in London, England, in graduate school.
I did. I did spend a year in graduate school at University College London. It was quite an interesting experience, to say the least. Studying abroad or even just living in a different culture makes you think about the world in a different way and think about how many different people are living on the same earth as us in, you know, different places. I'm sure that people hearing this will be all over the world. And it's really, I think, it's one thing to just think about where everybody is, but it's another thing to actually experience where other people are living and studying and moving and speaking in different languages and so on and so forth.
Well, I think University College London, if I'm not mistaken, has a sort of a world-ranked LLM program, doesn't it?
I'm not sure. I was not in the legal program there. I do know they are one of the better schools for law in the UK, but I was actually in the geography department. I studied environment, politics, and society in the geography department, looking at kind of the interplay between climate change, policy, and sociology, and how those three things really interplay to, you know, which have led to climate change or, you know, the different ways that our planet has been impacted from global development generally, kind of to take away some of the politics just to look and study how we've developed as a society since industrialization in the 1800s and what that has done, and maybe how that shaped our oceans and shaped our use of resources. And then maybe what are the different actors that are contributing to this as far as politically or sociologically, kind of how have we ended up where we are today? So definitely a really interesting thing to study. And I think it gave me a lot of range as far as what these problems are that exist in the world and how we might go about solving them.
Well, that's a lot of balls in the air, I think, at once, but it's important because one of the problems, I think, with school in general, academic programs, is that they almost create silos of knowledge, right, where they focus, you know, for example, if you look in the United States, the areas of tax and immigration, although they're completely related, you know, people in those, they practice in their own silos sort of thing. So the more interdisciplinary stuff, the better, and at least I think, and you seem to have carried that principle forward and now into the law MBA stuff.
But you're there's a really great book called Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World by David Epstein. And I actually just read that over the summer, but it's really great. It talks about how frequently in really large, like Fortune 500 companies, when academics studied great teams, they noticed that teams with a wide range of people coming from all different backgrounds and different kinds of problems solved problems much more efficiently than even teams of specialists trying to solve a problem that you would think that they're well set up for. Like a team of only virus scientists were worse at solving a virus problem than a team with some virus scientists, but then some engineers and some, you know, agricultural specialists, because people can, I guess, apply kinds of thinking and problem solving from one area to another. And so it actually turns out to be quite beneficial to have a wide range. And so that, I think reading that book made me think, okay, maybe I should jump into this business thing, this MBA thing, and it might pay off in the long run.
Well, I think it's probably a much more general approach to problem solving, for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you'll find in the legal profession that, I've actually been a lawyer, come to think of it, I think for more than 40 years. But, you know, when I graduated from law school, there was still such a thing as a general practitioner, you know, where people knew more than one thing and generally had to integrate a number of areas of law. And that concept of the general practitioner seems to be on the way to extinction today. Mm-hmm. But that's all very, very interesting. Now, let's talk a little bit about, I know you've been very, very interested in the LSAT. Both in your, I guess you've been a moderator of the group because you've been interested in the LSAT. And I know you've been working hard on a new LSAT program, a new LSAT prep opportunity. And I'd love to hear you talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So I decided that I wanted to launch a platform for people to study for the LSAT in maybe a little bit more gamified approach, a way where the materials were organized by difficulty. I thought that maybe we could use an on-ramp for the concepts and underlying materials needed to ace the LSAT, primarily logic and reading comprehension. So I decided to start writing questions that could teach these principles and teach these skills that people would need, but maybe watered down a little bit so that once you decide to maybe go start studying for the LSAT, you'd be a little bit more prepared, because that test is hard and it's hitting people with a lot of very difficult materials. And I don't think that there's great introductory materials to get people ready. And so what we've done is kind of divide the concepts needed on the LSAT into bunching them into different categories so that people can study. And as well, there's a bunch of, say, free logic games, for example, and those are really great. And if you complete the games with all the questions correct, you get ranked on a leaderboard with a percentile rank. So there's a bit of competition. So people can study against each other. And this was actually inspired by my own studying. See, when I was studying for the LSAT, I took all the logic games found on the test and I separated them by difficulty and then started recording my times in an Excel spreadsheet. And through that, after doing any logic game, I would move on to a different test and so on and so forth. But if I wanted to jump back to a game and maybe retry a game, I would play a little game against myself. I would try and see, can I beat my time? You know, how many questions did I get wrong that time? Can I get less questions wrong? And can I track how long it took me to play that game? And so that was, I think, a big part of the inspiration for LSAT Growth, the app that we've developed for Android and iPhone, where you can now play some of these logic games. But when you're done, you'll be scored, and you'll also have a timed percentile rank, so you can see, you know, how good am I at this logic game compared to my peers. And I think that's really helpful too, to see, you know, because every game's different. Some of them are really hard and they take more time naturally. So, you know, is a 20-minute time necessarily bad, or is that actually where the median score is for most people playing the games? So yeah, I wanted to develop something that people could use for free, with some paid features inside. But primarily, I wanted to make sure that there was good free prep out there for people to use. And so, over the next 3 to 6 months, we'll be writing more questions and developing that out so that there's the focus is certainly on making sure that there's free prep out there.
So basically, it's an app. Although looking at this earlier today, it appears that one can also access it just through the domain lsatgrowth.com.
Mm-hmm. lsatgrowth.com will have a web version ready, but we want to polish up the app a little bit more before we dive into getting it onto the website too.
All right, very interesting. Now, when you started your description of your work and your motivation in putting together the LSAT Growth, you said something I thought was very interesting, which was at the beginning, people are hit with all this really, really hard material. What is it that you think is so hard about the LSAT?
What I think is really tough about the LSAT is that chiefly pattern recognition can go a very long way. I think that it's not one test. It's more like a combination of lots of different skills tests. And so it's like if you were going to go onto an obstacle course and one time you might have to, climb a different rope, and then you may have to climb a rock wall, and maybe you've got to swim underwater. And the problem is that if you're faced with this obstacle course, you need to train for each of these things differently. Or maybe a triathlon is a better analogy. You've got to train for biking and for running and for swimming. But the problem with the LSAT, or what's kind of interesting about the LSAT, which a veteran understands, is that the LSAT changes and each section can be different every time. So if we're still in this triathlon analogy, sometimes you've got a really difficult run and a really easy swim, and other times you've got quite the opposite. And so I think what we're trying to do is lay out all the different skills underneath the LSAT that are useful to learn and build people up so that they can start recognizing how to use this logic, when to use this certain kind of conditional logic, which you need in some places and not others, which I think it's worth saying that, the LSAC certainly did not invent conditional logic. It actually comes from, as I'm sure you know, ancient Greece, with Aristotle, and even earlier than that, some 3,000 years ago. So it's just amazing how this applies today and is useful today for students. And it certainly made a difference in my life. I think that once you learn these kinds of logical reasoning abilities, you can, you know, the sky's the limit. You feel like you think differently.
Well, I will say this, that conditional logic or reasoning, however you want to describe it, is absolutely essential to be able to read statutes and law. Absolutely essential. I mean, if you don't understand that stuff, I mean, you don't have to study it in a formal sense, but if you don't understand what language implies in terms of conditional statements, and mainly what is an improper inference, you are going to be a very, very ineffective lawyer. So certainly that part of the LSAT bears a direct relationship to law school and becoming a lawyer. Okay, so you've identified conditional reasoning as one of the basic skills. I'm curious what your thoughts would be on some of the other ones.
Well, I think at the end of the day, the LSAT really comes down to a combination of learning how to do conditional logic, as well as learning how to truly understand argument structure. Again, something that LSAC doesn't, it's it's been an understanding argument. It's been a lot around much longer than any law school body. But it's so important to understand what is a conclusion? How do we support an argument? How do we support a conclusion? And so together with the nitty gritty kind of mathematical logic you need for the LSAT, but also with the more general kind of seeing the forest in the trees of where is your conclusion? Where is your supporting evidence? And where is maybe a sub-conclusion? I've noticed when I was tutoring that was almost the best place to start is just, can you get students to find a conclusion? Can you find where the supporting evidence is to back up that conclusion? And once you see words in that way, it's very hard to unsee an argument once you know how to read it. Do you find that to be true as well?
Do I find that to be true? Are you asking
when you see an argument, do you immediately find a conclusion and see how it's supported?
Well, I certainly, as I've gotten older in life, I've become more and more of a minimalist and hate clutter more and more. And I think that, part of finding conclusions and the reason for it is really decluttering information to a large extent. And when you look at, for example, the logical reasoning part of the LSAT, it would seem to me that there's two questions that you always ask. Always ask. The first is, what are you being told? And the second is, why? Right? I mean, if you're always focused on those two things, I mean, you've never strayed very far away from what's going on, and you're always looking at stuff that matters. But one of the problems...
That's a great way to put it.
One of the problems with the LSAT is that, they are very, very good at cluttering it up with, I would say, contextually similar but totally logically irrelevant information.
Separating the wheat from the chaff is what you got to do.
When it looks the same, right? That's the problem. It looks the same.
Right. Right. And that's, I think, part of what I'm trying to do is, what if we got rid of all the fluffy information just so students could start to see, only the good stuff? And if that's there, can they still figure out, what the different question types are, what the different ways to approach the test are, developing these skills before the heat gets turned up? And I think the LSAT starts on, even the very first question of any test. There's still a little bit of that good and bad of the relevant information and irrelevant information being disguised as relevant information. And I'm not sure that people are quite ready for that when they first start studying on day one. I think you've got to work up to that a little bit. I don't think it's too hard, but I think there's really room to build people up to before they're ready to start separating good from bad information.
I think there probably is. And one of the things I used to do when I taught this stuff was I would, give them an incredibly simple argument. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Then I'd say, nobody goes to a tutor or takes a course unless they're pretty frustrated with the stuff. Then I'd say, so what would LSAT do to turn that simple argument into something that's hard to understand or identify, right? And they would start adding this, adding that, shifting the order of these things around. All of this stuff matters, and it matters hugely. And I think that is a vitally, vitally important skill. And I think along with conditional reasoning that's what I would call foundational LSAT stuff, right? I mean, if you can't get a handle on that, you will be completely overwhelmed with all the garbage that they're going to be throwing your way. One of the things that strikes me is, if you look at, for example, I've not looked at this for some time, but thank God. But, I remember looking at the logical reasoning sections and the sheer reading burden, with the 25 questions or whatever it is, 24 to 26, I think is what it is, right? The sheer reading burden of the stuff is overwhelming.
Right. Absolutely. I think that there's a lot to read. And so, a lot of people, that brings up a good point. A lot of people say, don't look at reading comprehension first. And lately, I found that depending on where my students are, at least when I was tutoring, I'm not doing tutoring anymore, but for some students, you know, we've got to work on reading comprehension before anything. Because some people really, I guess, you know, without a better way to say it, need to brush up on their ability to read and understand what it is they're reading. And so one thing you can do for that, for those listening at home, is looking at news articles, even things that you enjoy reading. You know, I've looked at articles about exercise, about cooking, things with kind of scientific backing are great too, where someone's making a case for something, because that's the most analogous to the LSAT. So anytime that there's an article, you know, just a few paragraphs where someone says, oh, this is a new development in nutrition where maybe this diet works great compared to others or something like that, you can start to pick up on what's the case being made, where's the support. And so I found really good success running through these kinds of articles with students where I can dive in and ask questions like, okay, why did the author say this? Or what's the author's main point? The stock market's great for that too. There's fun articles to read on, you know, why such and such commentator thinks that Tesla stock is going to cut in half or something like that. And so if you look at these articles, it's a nice way to test yourself and see, where's your comprehension at? Are we ready to move into the LSAT if we're still having trouble with an article just laying out a point and, you know, clear as day, oh, we believe that Apple stock is going to rise 20% and here's why. And so, like you were saying, what's the what and what's the why? That was it, right?
Yeah. What is being said and why? I mean, as you go through the test, what's being said and why, you will always be focused on what matters. It may not get you the answer immediately, and I understand there's a wide variety of, you know, patterns, but they all seem to require that, you know, that basic skill, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
One thing that I wonder about is this. Let me just turn that phone off. Hang on.
Yeah, we got a ringer going. It's all good.
Hang on.
So talking about that, you know, what's being said and why it matters. Say that one more time. What is it and why does it matter? I like how you said it.
I don't know what I said. I think I probably would have said, what is being said and why?
What is being said and why? I'm with you. So let's go with maybe a couple examples of this. So I might say that Harvard Law School is the best law school in the country because their graduates can get any job they want and they can get themselves into Supreme Court jobs better than any other school's graduates. I'm not sure if that's true, but that would be my example of maybe a what's being said and why, or what's our argument and what's going into supporting.
Sure. Conclusion, Harvard Law School is the best law school in the country. And I lost interest after that, but I think you said something like their graduates can get any job anywhere they want. And then you said, you know, something else. So what you really have now, what's interesting about that, all right, I mean, let's actually dissect that. So we've identified the what and the why. Now, your why, whether by accident or design, was actually a compound statement. All right. It was not, you know, although it was two separate premises, it was constructed in such a way that it was one longer sentence. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one would want to clearly have a mental separation there, you know, why? Because if you're faced with a question, which of the following if true most weakens the argument, you know, one possible answer would be something that would weaken a premise, right?
Mm-hmm.
You also got to be clear, I think, at that point on how far your conclusion went, which was Harvard Law School is the best law school in the country. Is that what it was?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's very different from saying Harvard Law School is the best law school in the world.
Right.
But it would, which of the following must be true, but it would be the same, but it would be equivalent to saying it's the best law school in the state of Massachusetts, right?
Right.
So, you know, it's interesting how much you can do with, you know, with that kind of simple example. Now,
what, or another one, another thing I think is really interesting to do is you can take a basic argument and say something like, let's see here. You had a good one earlier. How about the Los Angeles Dodgers play in a baseball stadium that is filled with people and they play the sport of baseball? And any team that plays the sport of baseball in a large crowded stadium is likely to at least make some money. And so we can say that the LA Dodgers are likely to make some money. And so that argument tracks all the way through. But a nice thing to do is then to pull out one of those premises. And we can say, okay, what does this argument look like when we remove one of the premises? And that's a really nice way to start talking about sufficient assumptions, because all a sufficient assumption is a really nice and easy argument that then they go ahead and pull away one of the premises. And so I think if you start with the argument first and just get people comfortable with reading and understanding a basic argument, and then you can pull away one premise and things start to make more sense.
Yeah. There's all kinds of interesting things you can do about it. I mean, I hate to admit this publicly, but I guess I will admit it, is that I actually think the LSAT is an incredibly interesting test.
I do too. There was a reason I spent 2 years on it. I thought it was really worth diving into. I felt like I was learning a lot.
You should get a master's degree in LSATology or something if you spent 2 years on it.
Right. I'm still waiting for the governing body to give me one, but the jury's still out.
Well, you know, you'll get customers for your, you know, for your app. So that's, you know, essentially having the degree conferred on you, I suppose. But yeah,
you know what's better than that is that I wanted people to, I want other people to benefit from all of the hours I put in. That's more than customers was like, I just spent all this time learning all of this material and I'm going to go jump into law school and never share it with anybody again. It just seemed wrong. John. I wanted to put it out there.
Yeah. You're passing it on to the next LSAT generation, if you will.
Absolutely. I felt like after 2 years, let me brain dump everything I can possibly think of into this project so that other people hopefully don't have as bad of a time studying as I did and kind of dodging around from some truly horrible prep out there and overpriced stuff that's just not good. That hasn't really changed over the last, you know, however many years. It's just the same materials being pumped out and it's not as useful. And so we see all the time in this Facebook group people posting about wasting their money on this, that, and the other, only to realize that our community has been talking about forever that certain prep companies aren't very good and certain materials aren't so great. So,
well, it's, you know, it's not as though LSAT prep is an easy thing to do, although there's plenty of LSAT tutors and courses. There aren't a lot of good ones. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess the test is whether you can survive in the marketplace or not. I think that the general landscape of this stuff has changed quite a bit since when I was doing it. I mean, I was basically a classroom teacher, not an individual tutor. My impression is, or maybe it's just because of the people I know are people like you, that the whole LSAT preparation market has shifted more into tutoring. Is that correct?
I think it's a mix. I think there's a lot of online courses that are quite good, but at the same time, it's really hard to move away from personalized attention. And so people gravitate towards individual tutors who can teach the concepts.
What about the live courses? I mean, they're still running these live classes, these companies, you know.
They're horribly expensive, honestly. It's just so much less cost effective to do that, where I think we're better off seeing the development of more personalized mobile and online test prep. The problem is that it needs to be better. I think we need to hold test prep to a higher standard and get results for students. I think tutors are better at providing individualized feedback for students. And so, you know, test prep needs to make sure that it's getting people results. And so I would be very wary of buying, you know, spending thousands of dollars on prep that doesn't guarantee results or really show what kind of growth they can get their students.
Well, Matt, let me ask you this, okay? I mean, how much do these live classes cost these days?
Thousands.
You know, you're a test prep company, you take a live class. How much do those courses cost?
A thousand plus.
Okay, so let's say 1,000. How many hours of classroom instruction would those be?
Hard to say. I haven't seen too many of them, but I know they usually run something like, I think, 8 weeks or 12 weeks, something like this.
Okay, so I mean, is it like, would it be $60, $70 an hour sitting in these classes? Does that seem
something like that, I think. Yeah, it sounds about right.
And individual tutors, I mean, I know some of them are in that price range, aren't they? 60 to 70, some more, I understand.
Sure, but the way I see it is it's horribly inefficient for the market. You're having one person teach the information to one other person. Surely we could get everybody who has expert knowledge in the topic to come together and start to build out useful guides and useful information for the community to use, so that hopefully, I think access to this test and access to being good on this test shouldn't be a cost prohibitive thing. I don't think that should be the reason someone becomes a good lawyer is because of how much money they spent on their prep.
Yeah, well, to some extent, that's what I've conceived the LSAT study Facebook group to be. You know, a bunch of good tutors sort of, you know, coming together. And I don't know. I mean, I think it works to some extent, obviously. But, you know, that's what I find interesting about it. It's not like, you know, in the Facebook group, there's a lot of real competing approaches. You know, it seems to be more of a, you know, a collaborative sort of thing. But let me ask you this, Matt. You know, we've talked sort of objectively about what's out there. By the way, as far as the book thing, are there any books out there? Are there any remaining books that are not based on actual LSAT questions?
I don't think so. I don't think that there's many. You know what? I've seen a couple. I think Kaplan has made one in the past. It's quite old, but there are some that aren't based on actual questions.
Okay. And, you know, we're up to, what, about 90 released LSATs?
There's been 89, I think.
89, okay, since June of 91. So, I mean, are there people...
But I think the old ones are much less relevant. I think that to truly study a little nugget of information for those still listening would be... anything prior to LSAT 50, I want to say, is truly... not that great. And another thing is, if you know how many tests you think you're going to do, maybe add another 5 or 10 and start backwards. So if you think there's been roughly 90 tests. If you think that you've got an appetite to do 20 prep tests, which is a considerable amount of work, you know, add 10 more to that would be 30 prep tests, you know, just to get a buffer and say, okay, I'm going to do 30 tests of work. Well, 90 would be the most recent test. So subtract 30, you know, starting with test 60 and working your way forward seems like a pretty good method. I think that's another issue is people don't know where to start and where to go, and they jump into a random test, and then they're greeted with materials that A, may not be relevant, and B, are probably too difficult when they're starting the LSAT journey.
Well, would it make sense? So it seems to me that you know, we've got three issues going on here at once, right? The first would be, obviously, you need to do a number of sample tests under the time conditions, right?
Right.
The second thing is you need to be experiencing LSAT, whether in a time format or not, that is most consistent with what the test is actually going to be, right?
Right.
So these are the arguments for, you know, your, say, test 60 on, or say the second half of these things. But it seems to me, going back to the first part of our conversation with background skills, that those earlier tests are very valuable for dissecting arguments, aren't they? Conclusion, premise, irrelevant stuff, you know.
I mean, I think people could start on, say, test 60 and work their way forward. And the reason I think that's a good method is because it seems like a doable amount of work. Even if test 60 to 70 are kind of just training wheels, getting your feet wet without the timer, seeing if you can get through some of these questions and figure out what you know and what you don't know. I think that's the first step to learning anything, is kind of understanding the limits of your own knowledge, the limits of your own understanding. What do I know and what do I really don't know? And if you can, what do I really not understand it, that is. And if you can get through the first 5 or 10 prep tests and get a good handle on that, then maybe by test 70, you start figuring out, doing more focused studying under time conditions and things like that. That's kind mm-hmm. of a method I think would work.
Okay. Now, obviously, we can have the best objective, the objectively best material study program in front of somebody imaginable. Mm-hmm. But without the right kind of person to deliver that program to somebody, it's not necessarily going to be effective, right? So what, in your experience, your opinions, what are the characteristics of a really, really good tutor? What do they all have in common?
Oh, a tutor. Interesting. I thought you were going to say students. Good tutors. Well, I think good way. Tutors recommend, I think, well, like, okay, so what makes a good student? What makes a good tutor? What makes a good, I'll start with the hard part, with the more self-critical part. What makes a good tutor is recognizing, well, so I like to look at the science behind these things. And it turns out that the more work that your student is doing, the better. So you want your students to be working. You want your students to be doing the work. And it turns out giving hints so that students get to the right answer is generally not effective for learning, is what the science shows. I wish I had an article to quote for you, but nevertheless, I've done some research on this, and it's shown that what you want is for the student to be really kind of struggling through difficult questions. But, there's an asterisk on that. You want them to be struggling through the hardest question that at the end of the day, they can still get right. And so I think a good tutor is really aware on where is their student and are they needlessly struggling? Are they just working on something way too hard that's not going to help them? Or are they struggling on something that you really believe if they put another 15 or 20 minutes into, they can crack on their own and get a good understanding of. And so I think that's what it takes to be a good tutor, is to understand where your students are and adjust the difficulty accordingly, and to help them with that big task of what do I know and what don't I know. And so, because you can't outline your studying and outline where you need to go tackle until you know how to answer that question of, what do I know, what do I not know.
And what do you think of students that they're going to invest all this money in this, it's not only the money, it's the time, the opportunity cost of the time. What does a student need to bring to the experience to really make sure that they get the most they can out of it?
Student needs grit. Student needs to be able to say, I need to do this, or tell me what homework to do. Tell me what to do. I'm going to go home. I'm going to do it. And I'm not going to talk to you until I tell you for sure that I've done it. Or if I'm working on it and really having difficulty, I'll reach out. And I think that is what makes, you can almost predict, truly, I think I can generally predict which students will do great and which ones won't. You can start to get a feel for that on the first day that you work with someone, because the students that say, that really want it, that really push for it and ask for more work and say, okay, I did everything you asked me and then I did 3 more questions. That's the kind of person that does well in law school and that I think can get into great law schools, because, not having been to law school, but having been to graduate school, those were my peers at top programs. And so, I meet people who have really ambitious goals for law schools and say, oh, I want to go to a top 10 program, or, realistically a top 30 program. And it's a really big ask to say that you need to take studying really seriously. But if you want to get into a top program and you want to compete at that highest level, I think it takes that extra dedication, that you really set your mind to this as what you want to do and what you want to fight for. I think lawyers generally should have something that they believe is worth fighting for. And so staying tapped into that and motivated by that, so that you sit down, every day or 4 days a week, and really put in some hard hours in to make sure that you understand this material on your own. That's what it's going to take to get through graduate level work. And so I think either bringing that to the table or working on bringing that to the table is what it takes to be a good student.
Okay, and more generally, so that's the whole LSAT prep thing. I mean, if you were to give somebody a condensed, concise Reader's Digest set of guidelines for, so you want to go to law school, what do you need to do to get there? What would that be?
Don't shy away from reading in your spare time. Malcolm Gladwell, love Malcolm Gladwell. There's so many great books out there where an author makes a point. I think that's, believe it or not, really important to get your reading ability up. If you don't feel like you're a strong reader, if you don't feel like you did particularly well in standardized testing regarding reading, I'm not in the law school now, but I've got many law school students who live in the same building as I do, and they're reading about 100 pages a night or more. And so I think if you're not committed to reading a lot and enjoying that and understanding what you're reading, that's an issue. And I think that the conditional logic takes you a very far way. So what is it that's being said and why is it being said, like you were saying, is skill number one, and reading and being really comfortable reading. Those two skills will take you far on this test.
I think that one way of looking at the LSAT, and I remember people used to say to me, so what does the LSAT actually test? And I would say, it's a test of reading and reasoning in context. That's
Sure.
really about it. They just keep shifting the context. All right, well, that's really, really interesting. So, wrapping this up here, just to repeat a few things. First of all, this is Matt Leinwand, and I want to thank you again for your help moderating the group this year. It's been enormously
Oh, no
helpful.
worries.
And I
Thanks so
want
much.
to thank you also for the conversations we've had in the last year, which have really kind of helped keep me in the loop, with what's going on in this whole industry, and the sort of mindset of people trying to get into law school, which isn't great. So I thank you for that as well. We're going to be setting up another group, Facebook group called Law School Cafe, which is really, we've got all these people in the last year from the LSAT study group gotten into law school. And this is conceived to be a group where they can sort of share their experiences in first year law. And I want to thank you for agreeing to be a moderator of that group as well, which is up and running. That's Facebook groups, Law School Cafe. I certainly want to wish you success in your academic pursuits. I would wish you luck, but I'm not a believer in luck. I am a believer in hard work, and I know you're a hard worker, so you're going to do great.
Well, thanks so much.
And I thank you. Of course, I've already been through law school, so I don't know why I should thank you, but I do care about the LSAT prep industry, so I thank you for taking the time to develop what I think is probably one of the few apps that's dedicated to LSAT preparation. So, we will see people on the subways, on the buses, walking, crossing the street without looking where they're going because they're playing with the LSAT Growth app.
Let's hope
And
so.
you can find that at LSATgrowth.com. So let's pick this up again periodically, but thanks for the chat today.
Of course, and for anyone still listening, just remember what Seneca said, the ancient Roman philosopher, that luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity. I think that's certainly true.
There you go. Or there's that other, what is success? Success favors the prepared mind. Is that the other one? Something like
That
that.
sounds, it sounds right. Sounds right. Sound, we'll run with it. That sounds good.
I think what we would
Yeah,
both agree with, though, is that there's no substitute for hard work, and not a lot happens by happenstance in this world.
yes. And I think, the tutors and I, we go back and forth on this one all the time. It's kind of funny, but you can worry about the absolute best LSAT strategy that there ever is, but if you only put it into use 10 minutes a week, it's not going to do it. You've got to put in the hours. I think there's really nothing that substitutes for some serious hours day in and day out. And that's, there's no secret. Hard work is how it gets done. So keep
Well,
working hard, everyone out there.
it's
And
not just learning stuff, it's implementation. I don't know where I heard this, but I think it's absolutely true that, and probably conclude on this, there's all kinds of people who know what to do, but simply can't do what they know. And that seems to me to be the real key to effective LSAT preparation. So thanks very much, Matt. And
thanks for having me.
All these issues.
It's so great talking to you. Thanks so much, John.
You're very welcome.